One final segment to go, and again, we can either continue answering questions about the old exams or topics, or we can start up with our next lecture topic, which will be into type checking. Most of you have already seen the notes, and I've seen on Piazza people have been reading the notes. This is the spot where I have the various trees, and we talk about the various rules that have to be enforced. As you've probably seen, the cool thing about this is the transliteration is pretty straightforward. As you may be figuring out in this case, this is a great place to be building various kinds of subroutines that answer related questions in one routine rather than duplicating it. I'll talk about that when we get to that, either this lecture or next. But it's up to you. You're the customers, and would you have any related remaining questions about how to answer this or that or this topic or that subject to the exam tomorrow or next Wednesday? Or we can continue on then to talking about type checking. Any remaining questions? Questioned out, okay. Again, I'll try to get here a bit earlier tomorrow. The exam starts at 5:30. I'll come by, visit Mirror to get a drink and be here, and you can have any last minute questions, although it may be the case that everybody empties out. It's like situation. There's the old joke about soldiers are standing in line and says, we need a volunteer, and everybody takes one step back, and there you are sitting there. Situation. I need some volunteers to take an exam tomorrow, and everybody takes one step back, and the room empties very quickly. So let's go on, and then so what I have here is, you'll notice I have most, but not quite all, the type checking for AST nodes listed. In a couple of places, there are things missing, but I think they're relatively straightforward things. So for example, I have some type checking information on binary operation nodes, but I don't have them on unary operator nodes. But as you might imagine, they're going to be quite similar in that sort of thing. I don't think I have notes on how to do blocks, but I do have notes on how to do methods. And if you think about it, a block and a method, type checking-wise, are fairly similar. It's a situation where you have parameters in one and not the other. But basically, you have to open the scope and check the declarations and check the statements and so on. So when I get to the part about checking methods, even though I am not talking about blocks, most of what I'm saying there is applicable, or it's a subset, really. So starting out with some of the simpler ones, what you're going to have to do in these cases is, this is recursive checking. So normally, when you type check anything, you're going to have to type check the subtrees. In certain cases, it might be a situation where you don't necessarily need to visit a subtree if it's so trivial that nothing can go wrong. Even in that case, you may need to visit it if you expect information like type and kind to be set. Remember, there's type and kind information available typically for anything that's an expression, and types, nodes, of course, give you some information about types, so you have to be gathered. So in this sort of situation, we're doing a var decl node without initialization. So one of the things you do whenever you have declarations, be it a method, a constant, a variable, is make sure it's not already in the symbol table. There's one exception, and that is methods which may be overloaded. So in the case of, if you get to methods, in that case, you say, is this guy already declared? It may be valid that he is, as long as overloading's in effect, and this is an alternative overloading. But except for that one, there's no problem. People have asked on Piazza, is there any kind of other overloading? And the answer is not. A field and a method may not have the same name in the same scope. An array and a non-array may not have the same name in the same scope. We're not trying to be crazy where we push as many alternatives as possible. I'm just including method overloading because method overloading is popular, and it is something where we're starting to see more in languages. So maybe in future there is more overloading, and you should be at least fairly comfortable with handling it. It's not automatically impossible, but it makes the life of the programmer easier, but it makes the life of the compiler writer harder, and that's oftentimes the trade-off. I'm sure you do that in software all the time, and I was in a restroom, and of all places, and there was a little sign about do's and don'ts for employees. Instead of saying, wash your hands and be polite to customers, it was one of the things that, you know, make it easy for the customer and all that. If, you know, it's harder for you, it doesn't matter as much as it's easier for the customer. So we have the same sort of thing where compiler writers are producing the product and the programmers are the customers. So in this particular case, we're going to see if the identifier is declared or not. Normally when you declare something, it's going to need type and kind information. Oftentimes you get that from the kind of node it is. So if you visit the type node, it'll tell you what type it is. You can simply ask it. Remember, there's only a limited number of type nodes, and you can either have a little method that says, please give me your type, or you can look at the thing and say, are you this kind of node or that kind of node? In the situation, there was, what is it, instance of is usable. Say, are you an instance of this kind of node or that? So you can certainly extract the information from the type node. So you get the type node from that, and it's a variable because it says om of var decl node. The one with initialization, it actually is in the same block of code. I simply, for explanatory purposes, tried the simpler one and then the slightly more complex one. You really have the same block of code doing both. And that means you're going to have to say, is it the earlier or the later? And the way you do that is by going ahead and looking at the initialization subtree and asking, is it a null or not? Remember, there's a method that's always available called isNull. So you can go ahead and say, are you null? Null does not mean there's a null reference. There's a node sitting there, but it's one of these innumerable kinds of null this or that null that node. So the parser said if there was no initialization, the initializer is the null expert node, I would imagine. And you can say, Mr. Node, are you null? And it'll say yes or no. If it says no, and says yes, I am null, then the previous slide is applicable. Otherwise, this one, which is a tad more complex. So again, this part is the same. You look up the identifier and make sure he's not already declared. You then type check the initial value expression. All that means is you recursively call your type checker to visit that expression. It could be very simple, like a literal or a variable, or it could be a computation. You don't know and you don't care. He's going to type check it, and when he's all done, the root of that node is going to have a type associated with it, and that's the type you can extract. It's got to be the case that the initial value is a scalar. And here's a case, by the way, there's many cases on the succeeding slides where I'll say, is this guy a scalar or is that? That's a hint that it probably is a good idea to make a method that takes some parameters and says, for this particular type, are you considered scalar or not? Makes it more readable and you type a little bit less. So what is scalar in this particular case? I even tell you here. Scalar really means non-array. In this particular case, variable value or scalar parm. So we had a question on Piazza maybe a week ago or so of did I allow a string as an initializer, in this case of a constant? And the answer, as we'll see, turns out no, because of the scalar business. As we see, a string is not considered a scalar. If you want to do a little extra credit and you think it's a great idea, it would not be a terrible idea, and it's not all that terribly hard, to allow constants that have string initializers. I think I just put it in there because I believe it was a little bit simpler. But in terms of pragmatics, giving a name to a string is certainly a reasonable idea. And then, of course, you print the name rather than a string value, or you assign it to a character array for manipulation. That's not currently allowed, but it certainly could be as a slight generalization or extension. So then once we know that it's scalar, we put it in the symbol table where we extract the type, and again, it's a variable. The mere fact it's initialized or not doesn't change. It's a variable. Constant declarations. This is what I was just talking about a moment ago. The language as it stands now, since we're checking at point three, that the constant's value is scalar, the expression could not be a string literal, although the syntax allows for it. But again, if you wanted to change that, and again, be sure to put it in your README, because the TA has a whole series of standard tests, and this would be one where you'd be at variance with what the tester might expect. But it's not a bad idea, and I certainly accept that we allow constants to be string valued, named constants, so that I can give a name to something. And you're going to have to change in a couple of places, because that means that where I could be assigning a string literal into a character array, I could also be assigning an identifier whose initializer is a string literal. So you'd have to do a few changes, but nothing very deep or profound. So in this case, again, we check that the identifier name is not already in the symbol table. Hey, we do that a lot. And here's another way to get easy extra credit if you want to. One of the more common problems is people sometimes, because of mistyping a program or something, have what looks like an undeclared identifier. you meant to have this variable and you used it in your code all the time, and you forgot to do a declaration. I don't know what the coding practices here are, but certainly among undergraduates that I see, they write the code first, because that's the good stuff, you know, the stuff that does something, and then they fill in the variable declarations as a necessary evil. If you forget to do that, you'll get a series of undeclared identifier messages. The problem with that is one error, namely you forgot to declare this variable, could get multiple messages. Each time you use it, you're going to get a message. You can improve upon that by saying the first time I see an undeclared identifier, I go ahead and give a message. Error, blah, blah, is not declared. But now what you can do is you can put it in the symbol table with type error. There's a rule, pervasive rule, that says anything that has type error does not generate any further error messages. It's the old garbage in, garbage out. If I have erroneous information about the type or value or anything, how can I further check? But it would suppress the further messages. You can even do something cooler. Suppose it was the case that somebody did not have an undeclared identifier, but he misunderstood the fact that he could not use a variable before it was declared. What would happen then is you give an undeclared error message. You'd then see a valid declaration. You'd look it up and say, hey, he's in the symbol table, but he's in the symbol table with type error. What does that mean? That means he used it previously and it was marked as erroneous. And now I'm going to replace it with a valid declaration and what? What else am I going to do? I'm going to tell the guy he apparently used a variable before it was declared. And in this language, that's a no-no. He didn't get the declaration reference that he thought he did. No, you may have to rearrange the code or something, but that's a pretty nice message. The first one was invalid, and the second one says, hey, I noticed somebody seemed to be trying to use you before you were available. So it's not mandatory, but I think that's a nice little way to get some extra credit and I think produce a better product, a product that gives better error messages to users. So you might want to mention that or consider that. So in this case, we check that the thing is scalar and we put him in the symbol table, but now he's a value rather than a variable. Notice what this means. It's not a trivial thing. That means even though something looks like a variable, it cannot be changed. You cannot, for example, assign to a named constant. Because when you do the assignment checking, you can only assign to variables or parameters, but you cannot assign to values. It's the same thing, you know, you can't say 2 plus 1 equals 4. Or what they do in 1984, 2 plus 2 equals 3 or something, whatever they do at the end of 1984 to break the guy. Ident nodes. For identifier nodes, again, you check and see if he's declared or not. And then you check the fact that normally an ident node is going to be used in the context of a use. And that's an important point. How do I distinguish between a declaration of an identifier and a use of an identifier in type checking? Clearly, this guy is assuming he's already declared because I've gone ahead and looked him up. But what about identifiers that appear in declarations, like I saw previously? I didn't go ahead and look him up, and why didn't I do that? So I did the little trick. If he's a declaration, I don't try to go down there and type check him because his type's being declared right now. What I do is from my root, I take the field and go down and look at him, but I don't formally visit him for type checking purposes. And that's important because when you have an identifier that can be both declared and used, which is the type checker checking? Are you a proper declaration or are you a proper use? So what this structure is assuming is when I declare, I don't really go down there and type check them. From above, I look down on them, you know, like the deity down, you know, down below there says, who are you? You know, it says, I'm an identifier. You are now declared. But in this situation where I have an identifier, where it's not a declaration, I say one of the things I want to know about him is he properly declared? If he is, I get type and kind information from the declaration. And that's, of course, why we have symbol tables to give me that information. One thing that's not obvious, and one of the reasons I'm giving these detailed slides is, a lot of times there's something which later on becomes obvious, but if you don't do it early on, you have to go back and change something that you should have done right the first time. And in this particular case, this point three says, store a link into the symbol table entry for the identifier node. And the question is, why in the world would I do that? Because in number one, I've already looked them up. The reason for it is the identifier nodes are going to persist through the rest of the compilation, including code generation, but the symbol table will not. That seems kind of strange, but when you get around the code generation, the symbol table is gone. Why? Because anything that needed to be looked up has been looked up and it's already been resolved, a la point three. So what it would say is, okay, I'm an identifier and I know for sure, because type checking verifies this, that I'm associated with this declaration. And any information I need about the declaration, if it's a variable, I may need to know its address or something like that, or I may need to know if it's been initialized or not. I can find that by looking up at the symbol table link, but I don't need the symbol table. So what three is saying is, in future, you may want to know some more information about the identifier for code generation purposes and which declaration is appropriate. We've just looked it up. Let's save the information. So I save a backward link from the tree entry back to the declaration so I can always find that information in future. That means once the symbol table has been used, it can be thrown away. And that just simplifies things because why look up something twice when you know you've done it once and you know the answer is going to be? So that's what that is all about. Name nodes, which, yeah. Sure. No. This is, in fact, what you should do if you have notes in front of you, saying this type checking is really for cases where the identifier is a use of an identifier, not a declaration. What happens is in all the cases where I have a declaration, I do the processing up in the parent node and look down. I say, okay, he's the declaration. He's got to have an identifier. What might be wrong with him is he's already been declared. I'm doing a multiple declaration. But I don't expect him to be declared. I'm going to put a symbol table entry in there. So there's no purpose for me to save a link from the guy when he's already been declared. At that node, remember, all I'm trying to do is say, sitting at this node is some information. Like, hey, I'm a var decal or I'm a method decal. The trouble is the use, which is far away in the program, doesn't know until he does a symbol table lookup what the name refers to. So I keep a link to the symbol table entry to have that. Essentially, the symbol table entry is created from the declaration node anyway, so it's got that information. If I'm later on code generating, I'm saying, hey, I'm on a var decal node. I wonder what this guy's type is. Duh. I could just go down there and it's sitting in the node. What's not sitting in the node when I use, because when I have a use of an identifier, like A gets 1, it's not telling me that that's an integer or not. I've got to look it up in the symbol table, and it says, oh, yeah, he's an integer, he's fine, or maybe he's a Boolean, and I should not be assigning 1 to him. But, of course, that means I would have gotten a type error. But that's the information that I'm saving for future reference. Mm-hmm, that's right. Oh, I do define it. I put it in the symbol table. But the trouble is when I have a later use of it, at that particular use in the tree, there's nothing that yells out, I must be an integer. The way you find it out is you look up in the symbol table and say, in the rules of language, what's the closest declaration of this identifier that I can find? And if it's undeclared, that's an error message. If it is declared, I find out. It says, okay, here's the declaration that applies. And I'll keep a link to it because there may be information added later that is not available now. When we get around to code generation, things like addresses. Typically, variables are given addresses, but not yet, because the type checker doesn't know anything about code generation. His job is not to do that, and we keep each phase separate. But the linkage between declaration and usage is still valuable. I would even have the parser do that link, except for the fact that there's nothing in parsing that relates a declaration, which is in one part of a program, and a use, which is another. They're very far apart physically. So being able to set those links is something that a parser would not readily do. It builds the tree, and then later on, the type checker decorates the tree, as they call it, adds information and possibly links. So it's a matter of every phase doing its job in cooperation with the other phases. You're saying to yourself, it's not obvious it ought to be done that way, and I agree it's not, but experience shows this is a good way of doing it. So you're going to give me the benefit of the doubt, right? Well, okay.
Well, just to clarify, maybe this is an obvious question, but so every use of an identifier is stored in a separate identifier in the abstract index.
Sure.
Right? So there's one identifier for that identifier stored in the attached to the var decal node, and every use does it.
Right. And that's the thing, is that there's nothing in the name of an identifier that tells you automatically what its type and kind are. You could do that. Early languages had rules that integers had to begin with certain letters and floating points had to begin with other letters. But that we're way past that, and we have such complex types, that would be foolish. And if you think about it, you know, that's the sort of thing that's implemented indirectly when you're in Eclipse. You notice when you're in Eclipse, you can hover over a particular identifier and it'll tell you information about it. Like this was declared on line so-and-so and it's an integer or class so-and-so or whatever. What it's doing visually is what I'm saying doing here, namely create a link from this usage to the appropriate declaratory information and make it available. Eclipse does it in a more modern way, but in terms of processing, it gets exactly the information I want. And for all I know, maybe that's how Eclipse does it. It takes the tree and says, where's the link? Here's the declaration, and let's highlight that. Or what do they do, kind of ghost it or something if you want the information. I guess you hover over it. Do you have to click or something? Or some way of leading the identifier and tell it, please tell me what you know about it. Yeah, something like that. So that's roughly how it's being implemented. It's cool stuff, but remember, don't be fooled by the clever interface. Eclipse has nice, clever interfaces, but deep down, it's still doing the stuff we're learning about. Other questions about that? Okay, name nodes, as you're saying, is essentially an identifier node with the option that it may possibly have a subscript. So think of a name as whenever I have use of an identifier that may also be an array. And other identifiers are spots where I can't possibly have an array. So for example, when I call a method, I have an ident. I don't have a name. Because in our language, it does not make sense to call method m3. So it turns out some languages allow methods, functions, to be what are called first-class objects. And these are pretty cool languages. You can actually have arrays of methods. So if one method doesn't work, you can have another one. In these languages, and this is something that you'd appreciate, is you can actually have methods, that is, procedures and functions, improve themselves, become smarter. Situation, it can learn that trying to do an algorithm this way doesn't work, do it another way, and learn by experience. So if you're thinking about machine learning is much fancier, but the code to support actually the function you're running gets smarter or more acclimated to you as you go is certainly a very realistic opportunity, a realistic possibility. And sometimes you see code that does that. It starts to learn various inputs you put or various shortcuts you take and sort of learns them and anticipates them. So there are languages that make that easier. So in this case, a name node, again, is going to be an identifier possibly with an expression subtree. If it's there, that means it's subscripted. If it's not, it means it could have been subscripted, but it wasn't. So I can assign to an element of an array. So I can either say a(1) gets 0 or a gets 0. Type checking will be a little different depending on whether the array is there or not, but it's the same concept. So it says type check the identifier node. What does that mean? That's the thing I showed you a couple slides back. You visit them, look it up in the symbol table, find type and kind info. So when I say type check, I mean call the type checker and have him visit that node and do whatever he does, and then he's going to return eventually. And I say, voila, after I visited this guy, his type and kind information is available. It might be that he had errors, in which case there's the error type. So whenever I say check this or that, there's always the possibility that there's an error type, and then again, that's the garbage in, garbage out. If this guy was undeclared, I can't do further type checking because I don't know, you know what might have been the user's intent. So I don't want to produce bogus message saying, hey, you're not an array, but he wasn't declared. I don't know if he's an array or not. It doesn't make sense to complain about something until I've got a basis. So if the subscript value is null, that is, I ask the node, is null, are you is null, and I'm going to go ahead and copy the identifiers. If he's null, this means name node is really a synonym for ident. So I copy in the type and kind information, and I'm done. Otherwise, if he's not null, I have to go ahead and check the subscript value. And I have to check that if he's being subscripted, his kind is an array. No, it could be a regular array, or it could be an array parameter. So I'm not sure. Yeah, so an array means both kinds of parameters, array parameters or regular local variables that are arrays. You check that the kind of the index is a scalar, and it's got to be an integer or a character. It means in our language, like C, and I'm not sure anybody know about C#, that you can actually use a character as an index into an array. I mean, that's because characters typically are really just bytes, and bytes are numbers and numbers there. So it's allowed, and we allow it just to give you the opportunity to see that. And now you set the node names type to the identifiers type and the node names kind to variable. Be careful here. Let me finish this and then. This thing is a little ambiguous, and let me disambiguate it now. What happens is you check this name node's type to the scalar version of whatever it is. If the identifier's type is an array of integer, after you subscript it, you have an integer, not an array of integers. So be careful. This thing is subject to misinterpretation. But after you do the subscript, you no longer have the name representing an array. It's representing a value in the array. That's what this means to say, and if that's unclear, please mark it. And that's all we have to say for today. Maybe I'll see some of you tomorrow, maybe not. We'll see how many brave people we have. But anyway, I'll try to get here a bit before 5:30. You can ask any last-minute questions, and we'll do the exam.